Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, you just got back from Paris. But
a whirlwind trip.
Yes, no baguettes, no croissants, no walks or strolls up the Champs-Élysées. It was a quick in and out. And you also flew on a chartered jet with our newly installed Prime Minister Yair Lapid, even though there's a plane that's outfitted with like the coolest, newest, leather-seated, you got whatever you want on this Air Force One-style jet, but he won't take it. So what's going on?
So Lapid, this plane was approved when Lapid was finance minister, and it was against his opinion. So the cabinet...
Wing of Zion, it's called. Right. Knaft Zion, Wing of Zion.
Wing of Zion, yeah. And Lapid opposed it. He opposed it from the get-go. He's opposed it all along. Bennett basically didn't use it for the past year because Lapid opposed it. It's been ready for roughly
a year.
Like, it was finally approved like a few weeks after Bennett became prime minister.
But Lahav, what's this plane, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. It's kind of like, it has all the communication system. It's got like the ability to manage the country from the skies. It's
and
got
it
a
has
bedroom
very high
and a shower
security.
And a boardroom and everything, right?
Right. And it also has very high security. Whenever Israel rents one of these planes, usually from El Al, but it's also been from Israel in the past, they install like an anti-missile system under the plane. You can, when you're standing on the tarmac, you can kind of see it. It looks like there's like kind of a box attached to the plane. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for saying that, but it's right there for everyone to see. And this plane actually has a very advanced like system installed in it for security as well.
Mm-hmm.
Lapid's argument is it costs too much to deal with in the first place. Israel bought like a 20-year-old Australian plane that was out of use and renovated it, I guess, and put everything they need in it. But also, each individual flight will cost more than renting a plane.
So basically, just so our listeners understand, there's a plane, hundreds and hundreds of millions of shekels have been poured into it to buy it, upgrade it, fix it, install all this cool tech and whatever inside it. It's sitting on a tarmac at near Ben-Gurion Airport or at Ben-Gurion Airport for a year, has not been used. It has a pilot crew team in the Israeli Air Force, right? It's part of a squadron, I guess, and there are people who are ready to fly it. But we won't use it even though it's theirs. I mean, is this not a little ridiculous?
It is ridiculous. And we actually asked Lapid about it on the trip. And he was just like, each flight costs more money. We don't need it. And he's going to keep renting planes. I think, at the end of the day.
I don't get that argument, though. No, I don't understand.
I don't either, because I think, like, first of all, the respect of the office, right? It deserves its own plane. Every leader of the world, of countries that are smaller than Israel and poorer than Israel, they also come, if not in their own plane, then at least in like a nice military plane. They're not like renting, like, you know, I don't know, Agen Air or whatever for the Greek president. And
don't make fun of Agen Air.
No, I'm not. I'm just thinking somebody who comes to Israel pretty often. It's also just like, it's there, it's a project, the government and the cabinet voted on it. So it's also sort of like a disrespect to like continuity of government. But I think at the end of the day, more than any rational argument, Lapid doesn't want it because he thinks it symbolizes BB.
But here's the thing. I get that, okay, symbolizes BB, it's part of the BB hedonism or whatever you want to call it. But on the other hand,
don't you know, today the Likud said that someone in Likud said that BB is the least hedonistic person they know. Yeah. I don't know if hedonistic is the best translation for that word, though. But we're talking about
Nahantan,
you know, his love,
right?
Of cigars.
Isn't that the word?
Yeah.
He loves the good things in life.
Yeah, hedonistic might be taking it further. Right.
BB's the person who least loves the good things in life. I mean, we could just laugh at that. Seriously. The guy is notorious for being known not to walk around with a wallet, doesn't have a credit card. Lives off of people, the whole cigar, champagne, jewelry thing, and case 1000. Now that this woman, Hadass Klein, has taken the stand, and she's telling of how this assembly line of gifts was established, created, and how it was legitimized by the Netanyahu's. But getting back to the plane, to Wing of Zion, which for some reason reminds me of when I was a kid. You know, you get told a lot of fairy tales in Jewish day school, and one of them was that eagles are going to take
the wing
us,
of eagles.
Yeah, are going to take yeah. us and fly us to Israel when the Messiah comes, right? When Mashiach comes. So.
But that's also, I think, one of the operations to bring Ethiopian Jews to Israel was called that, right? On the wings of eagles.
And I was thinking as a kid, like, how does that work? Where do you like sit on the wing of the eagle? Whatever. Anyhow.
It's like the never ending story.
Yeah, exactly.
If you ever saw that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I love that book. But anyhow, the plane exists. It's there. And we're not, like you said, we're not a poor country. We're not schnorrers. We're not schleppers. We can be proud in our power that's militarily, economically, financially, whatever. Why not use this plane and travel like a mensch? You deserve it. Like I as a citizen of this country, whether the prime minister is B.B. Bennett or Lapid, I want my prime minister to arrive at his meeting with the president of France, which is the one that you traveled with him to, with Emmanuel Macron or with the president of the United States or whoever it might be, to travel like a proper president prime minister should travel.
100%. I agree. I think that it's just ridiculous. I mean, and every time we fly over the past year, I've taken a picture of the plane and I've tweeted and I've said, like, we have a plane for the prime minister, but we are flying in this LL.
So we should tell Lapid, and, you know, maybe he listens to this podcast, but we fully endorse him flying on the wing of Zion to his next overseas trip, wherever that might be. But in the meantime, Lahav, on this trip, you went to the Elysee, and there was a meeting between Lapid and Macron. What was this one quick in-and-out day visit about?
Well, before that, I want to give you, like, the color, which is that they were, it's like such a bromance. Like, we've known for a long time that Lapid and Macron are friends. Mm-hmm. They both have very similar backgrounds. They both sort of entered government from totally non-governmental backgrounds as Lapid as finance minister and Macron as economy minister. And they both started new centrist parties, and they sort of bonded over it and were in touch about centrism and that it's like a real thing and it's not just a compromise and how to promote the idea of centrism, etc. And over the years, when Macron has visited Israel, he actually met with Lapid, even though Lapid wasn't opposition leader. So we know this isn't just Lapid talking it up. When Lapid got out of that car, and which weirdly was like a Renault large hatchback and not like a limousine. Mm-hmm. But I was told that that's the most protected, the safest car in France.
The Renault. Okay.
it's like a specific.
Well, maybe it's because he doesn't want to take, you know, he doesn't fly the wing of Zion, so he can't go in a Mercedes or like a BMW.
Right,
he
exactly.
He needs to go in a Renault.
Exactly. But we, the reporter from Yediot really likes cars, and he was like, this is very weird. And we asked some French people about it, and they told us it's like a very, like bulletproof. Mm. Anyway, when he got out of that car, Macron was smiling at him like literally like his best friend came out of the car. Mm-hmm. Like they were just like hugs, arms around each other, like total bromance. So first of all, just like that was cute, actually. It was very cute. But then they came out and they gave their statements, and it was as if like Macron was part of the Yesh Atid election campaign. He was like, the people of Israel are so lucky to have you as prime minister. And then like, coming from a European leader, this is a compliment, even though I don't think it's what Lapid wanted to hear. He was like, there could be peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and you can be that historic figure. I know that you have the ability to make it happen. Yeah. I was like, wow.
Definitely a compliment. And you know, Lapid, like you said, he's played up this relationship that he's had with Macron for a long time and talks about him in terms of being a friend. It was a trip, though, that Bennett was supposed to do, right? And then Bennett, when he stepped down and the Knesset dissolved and Israel went to another election, going to be held on November 1st. So Lapid decided to keep the trip because it is his good friend and to still go to France. But after that, in the more substance side of it, it seemed like Hezbollah Iran featured prominently in their discussion.
Yeah. So France is important right now, I mean, on two fronts. Number one, they're part of the E3, the group of three European countries involved in the Iran talks, which is separate from the EU. The EU, it's worth saying, they're bureaucrats, unelected bureaucrats, are very gung-ho about the Iran deal. While the E3, or at least Britain and France, Germany's a little less vocal, they're a little bit tougher on Iran and a little bit more skeptical. They want to continue negotiating. They've not said that they don't want to negotiate, but they're a little tougher on Iran on their rhetoric. And Israel, at least under Bennett and Yair Lapid, have found them to be good sort of partners to talk to about these things. So there's that. And then with Hezbollah, I believe we talked about it last week, that Hezbollah sent drones over the, or maybe we didn't. Maybe it just happened since the last podcast. So Hezbollah sent three drones.
It did.
Drones.
It happened on Saturday, on Shabbat.
On Saturday, right. Yeah. So Hezbollah sent three drones to the Karish gas field where there's a rig set up. They set it up about a month ago and started extracting gas from that field. And Lebanon has been unhappy with it. And Hezbollah sent these drones, and the Air Force, the Israeli Air Force and Navy, shot them down. It was a joint operation. And, you know, France traditionally has influence in Lebanon.
Right.
I mean, it was like a former colony. And Macron has, ever since Lebanon basically became a totally failed state, and there was that explosion in Beirut, like Macron has really taken on Lebanon as a cause and tried to help it rebuild. So Lapid asked Macron to try to send Lebanon the message that, you know, we're negotiating on a maritime border. We are willing to, we want to close this. We want to finish quickly. Our positions are not that far from each other, but we're not going to do that if Hezbollah is threatening us. So they need to rein in the terrorist group that is part of their government.
Is there also coordination that goes on, you think, between Lapid and Macron ahead of next week's big visit, which is President Joe Biden is coming to Jerusalem for just like under 48 hours ahead of his visit to Saudi Arabia? You think that Lapid's kind of consulting also with Macron about that? Like, how should that visit go? What should he ask for? What should expectations be from Biden?
That's interesting. It's possible. You know, we had a briefing with Lapid. We asked him a lot of questions for like an hour. I don't think anyone asked him that specifically, so I can't tell you with certainty. But I wouldn't be surprised, just because within these issues that they discussed, and they also discussed military cooperation, you know, the energy crisis post-Ukraine war. And these are all issues that, you know, are going to come up with Biden as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of, if they came up in that context. And I know with the Lebanon issue, so Israel is pretty happy with Amos Hochstein, who's the top like energy guy or energy negotiations guy in the Biden administration, and who has been trying to be the mediator between Israel and Lebanon. Israel's happy with him. Lebanon has at least been letting him in and talking to him. So, you know, for them, that's not something to be taken for granted.
Right.
So definitely the Americans came up in that context. In
you know, I was thinking, Lahav, you wrote a story a couple weeks ago while Bennett was still prime minister, that Bennett was contemplating of having a barbecue together with Joe Biden when he comes to Israel. And, you know, kind of a way of creating, striking intimacy and like it make for a good shot, a photo of the two guys, you know, sleeves rolled up, flipping hamburgers and hot dogs and stuff like that. That's obviously not going to happen for Naftali Bennett. And we had spoken about this on the podcast, that Yair Lapid is probably not going to do something like that. But you know who did a barbecue together? Tom Nides is U.S. ambassador to Israel, and Mike Herzog, Israel's ambassador to Washington, in Washington at the Israeli embassy, put out a video, which everyone has to watch because it's just hilarious, of the two ambassadors.
It's on both of their Twitter accounts.
Yes, it's on their Twitter accounts. You can find it. Of like holding a July 4th barbecue. And it's just like so, I don't know how to describe it. It's cute, but it's also a little dorky. Is that the way?
Well, they're not winning any prizes for acting.
No.
But also there's like a big difference in personality where like Herzog is like this like army guy.
Oh, he can barely crack a smile.
Right. Speaks in a monotone. And Nides is like, his career has gone from State Department to like finance. Like his last job, I think his last position was like one of the top people at Morgan
right.
Stanley. So he's like a schmoozer.
And like he's from the Midwest. Like it's, you know, Minnesota, right? I think, you know, like he's.
Right,
he's like a
bubbly,
people's man, like a folksy guy.
Yeah, right. And just you know, Americans like to put on the show. Americans like to put on a show. And so there's like that really funny contrast. And it's super awkward, but also really like also just cute at the same time. Like they're trying. It's a cute idea. But it's funny to watch.
It's funny to watch. It does. I mean, there's clearly close coordination going on. You know, it does tell us that Nides was in Washington at some point, right? We know he's back in Israel because they had the July 4th celebration in Jerusalem, which he was at just the other night. But he was in Washington. I'm assuming a lot of coordination with Herzog and between Israel. And we know that Herzog recently met with Biden. He shared a photo of him together with the president.
You know, I asked about that photo, though, because I was like, oh, I'll write about this. And they told me it was like 2 weeks old. But Nides also came to – Nides was in Washington about 2 weeks ago, I would say. Right. And they tweeted about it at the time. It wasn't like a
– So, I mean, there's a lot of planning that's going into this trip. It's going to be tight. It's going to be – like I the scripts are written. What does Israel want to get out of Joe Biden's visit here?
I think the number one issue – right now is Iran stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, there was this amazing exchange between there's this guy, his Twitter account is AP Diplo Writer. He's the diplomatic reporter for the AP, but I don't remember his actual name. I think it's Matt. But I don't remember the last name. And he basically asked Ned Price, who's the spokesman of the State Department. He was like, okay, you keep saying that the Iran deal, the JCPOA, is not going to stay on the table forever, that there's a deadline, that there's a limit, that you can't keep negotiating it because it doesn't make sense after a while. And it's been 7 months and it's still on the table. They just went to negotiate in Qatar the other week, right, and nothing happened. And the Iranians keep demanding things that don't make any sense. And you keep negotiating. Like, when is the deadline? And Israel, frankly, feels the same way. Like, he's asking the question that Israel has been asking also for the past 7 months. And of course, Ned Price, like, sort of obfuscated and, like, didn't give a real answer and said it has to do with the technical assessment of the state of Iran's nuclear program. So I'm looking at it versus the non-proliferation benefits that the JCPOA would convey to us. Okay. So I think, first of all, it's that. Like, Israel wants to know, like, what is the plan? Like, there's clearly not going to be a deal anytime soon. So let's try something else. And you know, the U.S. is sort of trying to play it both ways, right? Like, on the one hand, they're still negotiating with Iran. And on the other hand, they're trying to start, like, the Middle East air defense alliance between the Sunni Arab states and Israel.
Right.
So in the cover story of this weekend's Jerusalem Post magazine, I interviewed Walter Russell Mead, he's like a foreign affairs expert, he's a professor, and he writes a column for the Wall Street Journal. And he was saying that, like, because I was saying, don't those two things sound contradictory to you? And he said, well, no, that the U.S. could also be using that as a way to push Iran to the table, to say to Iran, like, look, we are ready with air defense. Like, you know, we're flexing our muscles. So then maybe that could scare Iran into wanting to negotiate. But so far, that's not working. So I think there's a lot of questions.
I'm guessing also it has to do with Lapid. He wants this. This is going to help him score some political points, right? I mean, a successful visit.
Oh,
US
yeah.
President.
Lapid specifically, as opposed to the state of Israel. It is different. I mean, for Lapid, in addition to wanting, hopefully, the good things for the state of Israel, this will be great for his campaign because he'll look like a statesman. Anytime somebody else does a good job on foreign affairs, it punctures a hole in Bibi's whole thing of being in another league in international
Although
relations.
Biden will be meeting Bibi on this visit, right?
Yes. I mean, and that's customary to meet with the opposition leader.
Although I will say that, you know, now that Israel's in election mode, it's even more important that the president shows as much as is possible that he's not taking and he's not picking sides, right? He's playing the whole field. And they said, by the way, to their credit all along, and there was a lot of speculation that he might not come if Israel goes to an election, is that he's coming no matter what because his relationship is with the state of Israel and not necessarily with one prime minister or another. I give them credit for, you know, sticking ahead with this trip, right? But it will be very – he will have to be careful not to kind of smile more at one side than the other during this visit.
Yeah, well, look, one side will be the dominant part of the trip, right? Because Lapid is the one governing. I think he's also going to meet with Bennett. So that's like something extra that he doesn't have to do. Everyone knows, and it's very obvious, that the Biden administration would prefer that Bibi not win the next election.
Right.
I don't think that this is going to be make or break for anyone. Like, yes, Bibi likes to campaign and talk about his sort of international credentials, which are impressive, like, and are not in doubt, but, or at least not by me. But like, I think there are very few Israelis who at the end of the day are going to be voting on that, especially at a time of inflation and just price of everything is rising. You know,
Bibi even went to a gas station the other night. Did you see that? He went to a gas station and he says, I had to go to a gas station to see the price of gas. I mean, basically he had to do what us normal people do all the time. We go to gas stations and we see.
Right, well, when's the last time you think Bibi drove his own car?
Decades.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But what was funny was that he said, I have to go see the price of gas. When he was prime minister and the gas prices were going up, he would say all the time, you know, I have no control over gas prices. It's got nothing to do with me. But that doesn't stop him from using the gas prices to slam the current government.
Michael Eisenberg, who's like a big VC guy in Israel, he tweeted to Netanyahu that what causes inflation is printing too much money and giving it out for free during coronavirus.
Right.
So, you know, this is somebody who understands the economy better than I do, is saying to Netanyahu, no, actually, this is your fault.
Who cares what the truth is, Lahav? In elections, everything goes and everything can be said, right? And I think we sadly know that from four rounds of elections, and we're going to see that in this coming round of elections.
I also think you can't only blame Netanyahu, right? There's inflation and prices are going up all over the world. There's a war in Ukraine
going on.
But again, like you said, it doesn't matter because that doesn't help anyone's election campaign.
But that doesn't make a difference. And I think that everyone is just going to do whatever they want. We just have one more item, which I think is interesting to talk about. The Jewish Agency, our own Tzvika Klein, the diaspora affairs reporter for the Jerusalem Post, broke a great story this week of how the Jewish Agency in Russia received a letter from the Russian Justice Ministry ordering them to cease activities inside Russia. The Jewish Agency operates there for many, many years, definitely since the fall of the Iron Curtain, but even before, to help facilitate Aliyah, help foster Jewish life inside Russia. And this is a big blow potentially to the Jewish Agency's activities. Unclear exactly why and where it's coming from, but you heard from diplomatic sources that it's because they've discovered that the Jewish Agency was collecting information about Russian citizens. But what we also know,
they claim that they're collecting information about citizens illegally, which to me sounds like an accusation of spying.
Espionage.
I mean, the people I talked to were trying to downplay it, right? But you know, I think that they hope to just like get past this crisis in order to be able to continue to help Jews in Russia. And there is like a backlog of many Jews who want to make Aliyah, like thousands of Jews who want to make Aliyah from Russia. And just because of the sanctions, there's so few flights that it's taking a long time. So I think that Israel's trying, like official Israel is trying to downplay this in order to maybe be able to get back on track, but it doesn't look good.
Right.
And like, I don't want to like sell panic, but like, to me, it reminds me of like the Soviet Union. It's like Russia's in trouble, so they're going to scapegoat the Jews.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also some tension right now between Israel and Russia, right? Whether it's about attacks in Syria that Russia has blamed on Israel and has been condemning Israel, or the Israeli support for Ukraine that Russia also...
Yeah, but that's not a reason to punish the Jews who live in Russia.
Yeah, maybe for them it is. I mean, you know, for you and I, it wouldn't be.
It shouldn't be.
Of course it shouldn't be. So, but the story got interesting because the Jewish Agency, I guess in their attempt to make, you know, do some damage control, tried to say, well, it's not exactly seizing all operations. It might be some activities. In the beginning, they tried to downplay even the existence of a letter. Then later they confirmed that there was a letter. We obviously stand by our story, thoroughly reported by Tzvika Klein, with numerous sources who had seen the letter, confirmed the contents of the letter, and a government minister who also confirmed the existence and the contents of the letter. So we stand by that story, which was widely picked up across Israeli, Jewish, and international media. But I mean, you know, the Jewish Agency is in a pickle, and I totally get why they would want to try to do some damage control. What we've also discovered, by the way, Lahav, is that they were hesitant to even share this letter with the government here in Israel, right? They thought they could maybe try to solve it on their own, which apparently they weren't able to because Tzvika learned of it, and that's how it got out. But the whole letter was even preceded by a raid of Russian authorities on the Jewish Agency's offices, where they confiscated computers and documents. I mean, this is this is not a small matter, right?
Not at all.
This is troubling, and let's hope that Lapid can figure it out.
I mean, it looks like a first step towards basically banning Jews from leaving Russia. That's why I say that, like, as much as I don't want people to panic, like, it just reminds me of a much worse time in history.
Yeah, and we have to hope that someone in Israel can pick up the phone to someone in Moscow and get this thing sorted out. But definitely not something that can leave us with great optimism. What can give us optimism, though, is our interview with Avi Yorish. Avi is a dear friend, but is also the writer of a book called Those Shall Innovate, How Israel Ingenuity Repairs the World, came out a couple of years ago by Giffen Publishing. And he's a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. But the reason we spoke to Avi is he is a dual Israeli-American citizen, American-Israeli citizen, who recently was part of a trip of about 50 people from 13 different countries, bunch of people there who have Israeli citizenship, who went to Saudi Arabia and visited the holy city of Medina. He published an op-ed in the Jerusalem Post last week where he told of this visit. And it's interesting because in Biden's upcoming trip, Saudi Arabia will feature prominently. We speak a lot about this with Avi Yorish. So stay tuned for our interview. We're talking to Avi because we are on the eve of a visit by President Joe Biden to Israel and to Saudi Arabia. And Avi wrote a piece in the Jerusalem Post this past Friday in our opinion section, which the headline online is, "I went to Medina as a Jew and Biden should go too." So Avi, it's great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. And why don't you tell us what you can about this unique trip that you were a part of? I know there were about 50 or so people, lots of businessmen and women from 13 different countries around the world, many of them also, like yourself, dual Israeli and whatever citizenship. So that's how they were able to go to Saudi. Tell us what it was like.
So, Yaakov, let me just say what a pleasure it is to be on the show. You are a longtime friend and colleague. I'm a longstanding reader of the Jerusalem Post. What a pleasure it is to be here today. It was, in one word, an extraordinary trip to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. This was my second trip to the Kingdom. This was planned as a trip to really lean in to build a bridge, both in terms of the business community, in terms of cross-cultural understanding. We had a three-day trip. As you mentioned, it was 50 members of the business community, businessmen and businesswomen, many of whom, all of whom were extraordinarily close to the state of Israel, openly so, many of whom had dual citizenship. And the trip really rested on two pillars. One were meetings with government officials, members of the business community, and two, a trip to the holy city of Medina. And the trip to Medina really was planned in order to telegraph to the Muslim world that we have come to understand, we have come to see one of the birthplaces of the...
Avi, I don't want to interrupt, but I don't know that all our listeners know the significance of Medina. So why don't you share with us that?
Yeah, Medina was the city of the Prophet Muhammad's birth. For 1,300 years, no non-Muslim has openly gone to the city of Medina. It is the second holiest city behind Mecca. Mecca is the city to which Muslims are obligated as one of the five pillars of Islam to make pilgrimage to at least once in their lives. Medina is the birthplace of the Prophet Muhammad. It is where he is buried. Two of the four righteous caliphs are buried next to him. And there is an open space for Jesus, the son of Mary. There is a gravesite for him that is empty, but one that pays tribute to his place in the arc of history. And so we secured special permission to go to the city of Medina and visit the mosque, to which we did. And there I would say basked in the glory and the specialness of that particular place. We went to seek to understand and pay tribute to the birthplace of Islam and telegraph to the greater Muslim world that we as members of the Jewish/Israel, members of the Israel community, are here to really seek to understand you and telegraph mutual understanding and mutual respect.
So, I mean, Saudi Arabia is not a place where like an organized group of 50 people can just come and visit easily. It's not like in Israel where we have groups like that all the time. And the government had to know what you were doing. right? The government had to know who this group was and why you were there. So why do you think that the Saudi government wanted this group or allowed this group to visit?
Saudi Arabia is going through a significant transformation and has been over the course of the last few years. You have a country that is looking around and seeing a tremendous number of threats, A, and B, a certain number of opportunities. When you look at the threats that are known to all, you have Islamic radicalism, specifically from a place like Iran, and you have a very unstable region. One. Two, when you look at the most important commodity that Saudi Arabia extracts from the ground, everyone knows that there is a finite amount of oil. And the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS, is very aware of the fact that he needs to diversify their economy away from oil, just like other countries in the region have done. And that really includes all realms. And we all know, living in the region, there's a significant number of issues that we all face collectively. Water security, food security, fintech, AI, space, disaster resilience. These are places that the kingdom has identified as being strategically important, just as Israel has. And MBS has come up with what they call Vision 2030. This came out about 5-6 years ago. Vision 2030 is a living, breathing document. All the listeners of this podcast can certainly go online and see the goals that Saudi Arabia is trying to achieve by the end of this particular decade. And they are a robust set of goals. And the kingdom has made a significant amount of headway over the course of the last 5 years in moving forward towards achieving those objectives. And when the kingdom and those in the government and in the business community look around, they see Israel as being a potential ally. They know that in order to achieve their objectives in the Vision 2030 plan, Israel has to play a major and important role in that particular set of objectives. By bringing in 50 members of the business community from all over the world, 13 countries, those who are extraordinarily connected to Israel, have Israeli citizenship, they're essentially, I believe, telegraphing to the rest of the region, we know that we want to work with those that are connected to Israel and helping solve our domestic challenges. And when I mean domestic challenges, I mean specifically moving off of oil and really variating and diversifying their economy and tapping Israel's innovation ecosystem, A, and B, it's an extraordinarily stable place. Speaking from a defense perspective, they know that they share a common enemy with Israel, primarily Iran. When Saudi Arabia looks at the region, they realize that it's a very unstable place. And one of the keys to their success ultimately rests with the Jewish state, the state of Israel. Coming out of our meetings, there's some interesting takeaways. One, when Israel thinks about its startup ecosystem, the startup nation, it really is taking startups and then in many cases, either scaling them up and exiting. In Saudi Arabia, some of the more interesting conversations that we had centered around that, but also centered around how do you fund those types of products, or rather fund those types of companies and remit those technologies back to places like the kingdom. Water was an issue that came up on a regular basis. Medical technologies on a regular basis. Defense on a regular basis. The conversations that we had with Saudis of all stripes and all varieties in the business and government communities, they were extraordinarily, they were well-informed. They were nuanced conversations, both in terms of the technologies coming out of the country, but frankly, also looking at it from a political spectrum, the parties that were in place, the individuals that were playing a role, whether the coalition was going to fall or rise, who the next prime minister might be.
What's the familiarity with all of this? Like, do they ask specific questions about Bennett or Lapid or Netanyahu? Like, was your sense that they're following, they're tracking this stuff, they're actually interested in the personalities behind it?
Absolutely. There were definite questions as Bibi, Lapid, and Bennett. Those are three names that came up pretty consistently. But also there were questions about what the role of those who were moving to Israel from an Aliyah perspective, where was the startup nation going from a tech perspective, a vision for Israel, where Israel was going in the next 10, 15, 20 years. Conversations we had really centered around the year 2030. As you know, Yaakov, we talked about this many times, given that my next book is on looking at a brief history of the future. We consistently talked about what were the major milestones that were happening around the year 2030. And me and you've spoken about this many times. By 2030, a computer is going to process faster than a human brain for the first time in history, and therefore allowing us to have thoughts that we've never had before. By 2030, we will have kicked or solved or really cured a certain number of cancers. By 2030, we're going to have a man on the moon on a consistent basis and on our way to Mars. By 2030, we'll have autonomous vehicles and EVs proliferating the planet. These are conversations that we were having with the Saudis in terms of where was the world going? What are the grand global challenges that we are going to face in the coming decade, two or three? You know, we've talked about pretty consistently that by the end of this century, we will see 50,000 years of human change. And that really is something that none of us can really process properly. And Saudis are aware, or at least the demographic of Saudis that we were dealing with, which was the who's who of Saudi society in the business and in the government community. Where are we going in the decades ahead? And Saudi Arabia knows that it needs to reach out and potentially cross the bridge to countries like Israel in order to help it achieve its objectives.
Okay, so you explained very nicely the business cooperation and why they need innovation and the oil and all of that. But we're coming on a point now where next week it's very possible that there will be an announcement of some sort of baby step style normalization between Saudi Arabia and the state of Israel. What's being spoken about in Lahav has written a lot about this is some sort of deal with the islands that are in the Red Sea between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And Israel has to sign off because of the deal back that ended the Yom Kippur War and saw multinational forces, peacekeeping forces deploy there. And in exchange, Israel's going to get some planes that it's civilian aircraft. So El Al or Kir or whatever will be able to fly over Saudi to get to the Far East. Currently, they're only able to fly over Saudi Arabian airspace on their way to Abu Dhabi, Dubai, or Bahrain, for that matter. When you were talking with the Saudis, was your sense that they're prepared for full normalization, like what Israel has under the Abraham Accords with the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco? Or is it going to be a longer process? Like, what is upholding them from coming to the table and doing what these other three Arab countries have already done?
Look, my sense is that this is something that they're interested in pursuing, that this is a move that only the royal court and MBS is able to take in his purview. The members of the business community and members of the government that we spoke to were certainly open to such a possibility, but really signaled to us that this is a decision made at the very, very highest levels. But that they were open to it and curious. These were individuals that came in with a very open mind to all of the benefits that a relationship with the state of Israel and members of the Jewish community around the world could work together to achieve a greater future for this generation and for all those that follow.
You know, a big issue these days, of course, with Biden visiting is that he's been very reticent to talk to the Saudis. He said he thought they should be a pariah state after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And now he's sort of coming around, apparently because of oil, even though when people ask Biden, he denies it. What were people saying about U.S.-Saudi relations? I mean, I know a lot of the group was American, including you.
The conversations we had, they were tough conversations. They were not easy conversations. And no one shied away from the hard issues, including the Khashoggi chapter. There were a tremendous number of conversations on where Islam was going and the, I will say in quotes, the reformation of Islam and where Saudi Arabia wants to take where is Saudi Arabia going to lead the Muslim community as the keeper of the two holy cities and the role that it plays. There were a lot of conversations that took place on where's Islam going, where are the relationships between Muslims, Christians, and Jews, where are, as a society, how is that society reforming when it comes to women and women's rights and human rights? So we certainly had a whole host of nuanced conversations. There were certainly from a say from a feelings perspective, the Saudis that we spoke to were had very mixed feelings about this administration turning its back on Saudi Arabia. Certainly comments like the pariah comment that President Biden made was certainly not seen in a positive light. We were there before Biden announced his visit. And so that really was not on the agenda, but there was certainly an understanding that we were entering a new era in the region. And there was more of a focus, at least with our group, much more of a focus on the region rather than a greater global conversation. It really was, where are we going as a shared society? Where are we going as a shared region? And where could we go from here?
Avi, one of the things that's interesting in the piece that you wrote for the Jerusalem Post is you quote there the Bala Tanya, right? The writer of the Tanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the basically the founder of, to an extent, of Chabad. He was the first Rebbe of Chabad. I just found that to be a great quote. A little bit of light dispels a lot of darkness. And your point was to say that, you know, you got to share some of these stories so we can actually bridge these divides that currently exist. I wonder what the Saudis thought when they're reading quotes from the first Chabad Rebbe in a piece about Saudi Arabia. And is Chabad yet in Saudi Arabia? Like, did you go to a Chabad house there? Did they prepare for you kosher food, try to put some tefillin on you in Medina? Was that going on?
So to the best of my knowledge, there is no Chabad house. There is one openly religious figure in Saudi Arabia who we did not visit while we were there. We did have a certain number of religious Jews who required kosher food. We flew in kosher food from the United Arab Emirates. Certainly the quote on bringing a lot of light, I am a big believer, and certainly we've talked about this before, Yaakov and I, that Israeli technology represents the best asset that Israel has, and that from a light perspective, it is our great privilege and responsibility to bring more light to the world. And we are seeing that happening today through Israeli tech that is curing the sick, feeding the hungry, helping the needy. That was really the main thesis of my last book, Thou Shalt Innovate, which incidentally was translated into Arabic and is now free to download from my website. And it has gotten a significant number of downloads. When we look to the future, I think the conversations we really had were centered around, how do we bring more light? How do we have a shared society? How do we make a better future for all of our children collectively? And how do we solve these grand global challenges? And that really was refreshing. The conversations we had, certainly having those conversations in Riyadh and in Medina, were a refreshing set of conversations that I hope will bring us to a better place. There were a fair number of individuals that were not excited about this piece coming out, because there will be, I suspect, a tremendous amount of, let's just put it, a wide gamut of responses. And with that said, ultimately, the possibility of starting a dialogue that centers around seeking to understand and then be understood, going to the birthplace of Islam, I believe telegraphs a tremendous amount of goodwill to the Muslim world. It says to them, we're here to understand, we're here to cross the bridge, we're here to demonstrate mutual respect and mutual understanding. And I certainly share with our Saudi friends, I said, just as I'm coming to Medina in order to understand you, it would be my great privilege and honor to host you at my home in Jerusalem and take you to the places that speak to the birth of our civilization in Jerusalem. And there was a great desire for that to happen in the years to come. And that really was, that is a new story. That really is as I think about the conversations that I want to have with our Saudi friends, this is where I wanted to go. I'll share with you an interesting story. Just before I went to Saudi Arabia the first time, my oldest son was very, very concerned. You know, we'd had conversations about the tougher issues on women's rights and human rights and where the kingdom has come from and where it's going. And just before I left the house, my oldest son pulled me in for a last hug. And I said to him, I hope one day you too will go and build bridges with our Arab cousins. And he says to me, Daddy, they're not our cousins. I said, Aiden, what are you talking about? They're our cousins. And he turns to me and says, Daddy, the Torah says they're not our cousins, but they're our brothers. And ultimately, when I think about my oldest son and I think about the words that he spoke about, we, if you look at the long arc of history, Israel is located in the Middle East. It is not located in Europe. We're not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere. This is a shared society that we have the great privilege and obligation to build together. The technology coming from Israel today can and will be used to make the lives of citizens around the Arab world much, much better. And together we are stronger. And I truly believe that we are on the cusp of a much more verdant, peaceful era. And many more countries will come into the Abraham Accords, and we will be in a better place in the years ahead.
Very well said, Hear, Hear. Thank you so much for being with us on the podcast today. Avi Yarish, businessman, analyst, author. And we'd be happy for you to update us on your future adventures.
I'd be happy to come back to the show anytime, and looking forward to seeing you soon in Jerusalem, Yaakov in particular, for our Men's Day coffees and parks around the city.
You got it. Thanks, Avi.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, all the major podcasting platforms. And if you enjoyed it, please send it to your friends and family and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. And we will be back next week, as always.